from KQED.
Coming up on Forum this morning in our opening hour, the Federal Reserve announced yesterday that it would raise interest rates for the first time since 2006. At a range of 0.25 to 0.5%, the rate hike indicates confidence in the economic outlook for the United States. Many economists support the decision, citing recent job growth and economic expansion as evidence that the U.S. economy no longer needs low-cost lending. But others have expressed concern that with low inflation and stagnant wages, the economy is not ready for higher interest rates. We'll discuss the decision and take a look at how it might affect your wallet. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Yesterday, the Federal Reserve's Policy Setting Committee voted unanimously to hike interest rates, and this marks the first time in close to a decade that the Fed has raised interest rates, arguing that the U.S. economy has presently overcome the financial crisis of 2007 to 2009. The nation's central bank has raised the benchmark interest rate by a quarter of a percent to between 0.25 and 0.50%, and this morning's opening Forum hour, we discuss the rate hike and what it may mean for the U.S. and California economies, for home and auto sales, and for your pocketbook. And we have a panel, let me tell you, who is joining us for the hour. We first want to welcome Ken Goldstein back to Forum, economist with the Conference Board in New York City. Morning, Ken Goldstein. Welcome.
Thank you.
Glad to have you. And also glad to have Adam Sarhan, who's CEO of Sarhan Capital and a contributor to Forbes.com, also joins us from New York City. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And thank you. And let me also welcome Mark Schneep, who is director of the California Economic Forecast, which prepares forecasts and economic commentary on the regional economies of California. And he joins us this morning from Santa Barbara. Welcome, Mark Schneep.
Hey, thank you. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Glad to have all of you. Let me begin, Ken Goldstein, because I know that the Conference Board actually today, I believe, released an economic report. And I'm wondering if you're in sync with what the Fed is saying, because what they're saying essentially is economy looks strong, it looks good, and there's confidence that it'll hold up under higher borrowing costs.
Well, I think that those two things. One is that the economy is doing okay, it's not doing great. But the second thing is that a quarter point move at the short end of the yield curve is not going to do much to the domestic economy, especially not to the non-financial domestic economy. And so this is certainly not only this increase, but the one they do in March is certainly in line with where the economy is and where it's headed.
Well, what about effect on, you know, we keep reading about mortgages, credit cards, especially auto loans, because the auto industry has had pretty much cheap loans that have kept things moving pretty quickly.
Well, I mean, auto loans are probably not going to be affected very much, if at all, certainly not right away, and mortgage rates even less so. And so, again, in terms of consumer spending, which is what's driving the U.S. economy, this is really, for the consumer, this is much ado about nothing.
So it's just symbolic, Adam Sarhan?
For sure. That's a great point. It is much ado about nothing. It is very symbolic in nature. The real impact is nominal at best. It's more of a psychological impact. But the important thing from an investing standpoint, I've argued for a long time, there's a big disconnect going on between Main Street and Wall Street. You know, Wall Street for months has been ready for a rate hike, but Main Street simply is not. And if you look at the data tells you that a consistent increase in rates at an normal path going back historically and looking at a normal series of rate hikes, the Main Street simply is just not ready for that. The Fed knows that, and that's why the Fed has been telling us all year they're going to raise rates, but every meeting up until yesterday, they keep kicking the can down the road. And when they did raise rates yesterday, they still attached the word gradual to future hikes, making it very, very clear that the easy money stance is alive and well.
Well, what does this mean, for example, if it means much at all for the labor market, because inflation is going to be a part of the whole picture, and I, what I'm hearing from both of you is it's all pretty marginal.
You want me to grab it?
Yeah, well, sure. Go ahead. Let me go to you, Adam. Yeah.
Sure. So there's two things. Number one, the Fed's got a dual mandate. Their job, essentially, is to help the economy slash keep unemployment near full employment, near 5% historically. And then the second mandate is to keep inflation near 2%. At this juncture, deflation is more of a threat than inflation. If you look at global commodity markets, if you look at even equity prices and transports or anything related to simple economics, 101 tells you that commodities is a function of supply and demand. Right now, demand is waning across the globe. The global economy is weak. Every major commodity in the globe, except for maybe one or two of them, cocoa and maybe one other commodity, every other major commodity is in a very, very steep, protracted, multi-year bear market. And that tells you that demand is just simply not there. Now, you could argue one commodity, you know, oil, for example, there might be a supply glut, or some other one-off commodity could be a supply side of it. But when you have nearly every major commodity in the globe in multi-year downtrends and very, very steep bear markets, that tells you that, you know, the global economy remains very, very weak. And other countries across the globe, like Japan, Canada, Australia, the list goes on, are either in recession or very close to recessions. And now we have a situation where the Fed's beginning to raise. The Fed knows that, and the U.S. economy, it's doing better, but it's not at the point where it can sustain a normal, you know, protracted rate hike like they've done in the years past.
Yeah, Ken Goldstein, we have this huge global bear market, but what I'm wondering about is every other nation that's raised rates has had a backtrack, and they found that the economic conditions just couldn't handle the higher rates. So we're doing something kind of in a maverick way here, aren't we?
Well, we're in a different position from a lot of other countries, but I want to come back to this idea that the globe might be close to a global recession. I don't think that that's borne out by the data from the PMIs or the leading economic indexes. Certainly the global economy is slow, but it's not slowing. And I think that, you know, in a sense, it is this whole idea that inflation is so low, keeping interest rates so low, that really goes across the board. And then, yes, it does reflect, you know, slow demand, but it's slow demand, not slowing demand. The U.S. economy is the exception, growing actually a little bit above its long-term potential. And what that has done already is drive the unemployment rate down to 4%. By this time next year, it's going to be 4.5% or less. That's going to put upward pressure on wages, while there's little pressure, as we just heard, on the inflation side. And so that's the pressure going forward. That is not enough to keep interest rates so much lower in the United States than where they would be in normal conditions. And so what's really important to understand here is what the Fed did now and what they'll do again in March is normalize rates. This is not a tightening monetary policy.
Well, Adam Sarhan, what's the effect going to be, as you see it, on the dollar of this rate hike, if any?
Yeah, I think, Ken, that's a great point, too, where it's more of a normalization. Everyone's talking about tightening. This is just getting back to quote-unquote normal. The answer to your question about the U.S. dollar, well, the U.S. dollar is in a very strong bull market. It's been in an uptrend for the last year and a half or so, if not longer. And other, Forex or currency markets across the globe are suffering and suffering hard. And that depends on which side of the equation you're on, import or export, and from what country, could be very, very strong or very, very detrimental to your business. But as far as an investing standpoint, clearly, even look at today, for example, you've got the dollar up almost 2%, which is a huge move for a major currency. And then you've got nearly every other currency across the globe down about 1.5% to 2%. The euro, the Canadian dollar, the Aussie, et cetera, et cetera. So clearly, investors are telling you that go-long dollar trade, which is very crowded, continues to work right now.
And again, Adam Sarhan is CEO of Sarhan Capital and contributor to Forbes.com, and Ken Goldstein is an economist with the Conference Board. Both are in New York. Mark Schneep is in Santa Barbara. He directs the California Economic Forecast, which actually prepares forecasts and economic commentary on the regional economies of California. Any effect in any major way, especially for consumers and people's wallets here in California that you see, Mark?
You mean of yesterday's move?
Yeah.
Well, you know, as Adam said, it's a psychological signal. And in this case, it's a psychological signal to homeowners and potential home buyers that this is just the end of an era of extremely low mortgage rates. Ultimately, you know, these rate increases that we anticipate through 2016 and even going into 2017 will result in higher mortgage rates, which are going to increase monthly payments. So this first hike may induce a little bit of a psychological move to rush to refinance now, and also a rush to purchase that new home to lock in the last of the lowest mortgage rates. So, again, it's more of a psychological thing. We may see a little bit of a knee-jerk reaction because, again, it's the end of this long interest rate low period. So first-time home buyers would be impacted the most by rising rates since they tend to struggle on making those monthly mortgage payments. So, you know, I'd say pull the trigger now.
What do you see as far as housing prices then, specifically?
Well, you know, rising, you know, housing prices are going to be much more influenced by supply. And that's what we don't have much here in California, for that matter, in the entire nation. You know, housing starts are just so low, but even lower in California. So I think the bigger factor is the fact that, you know, we just don't have enough supply. But rising mortgage rates over time should help to dampen down home price inflation in 2016, even going into 2017.
And what about the figures that the Fed's putting out? I mean, there's certainly been some calling into question about those figures, especially where jobs are concerned, suggesting that maybe we're not talking really about the impact on many people in the economy or people who are looking for work and so forth and not necessarily getting the numbers right, in other words.
Well, you know, we are close to full employment, and in all the measures of the unemployment rate, even the part-time, you know, measures like U6, I think that's the statistic, so everything is coming down very nicely. We think we will actually be at a full employment economy by, well, no later than the summer of next year. We already are seeing indications that wages and salaries are moving higher, certainly a lot higher now than they have been during the recovery slash expansion period. So, no, you know, there may have been some criticisms of some of the labor market numbers, but for the most part, you know, we're getting good employment numbers, and we're going to reach a full employment economy in no time here.
Also, there's talk, by the way, we should mention about a second hike maybe coming up in April. I'm interested in hearing from you, Ken Goldstein, what you think the funds will look like next year.
Well, I think that, you know, what we're looking at here is, you know, an increase at the short end of the yield curve and very little move at the long end of the yield curve. And I think what's important to understand here is that one of the trade-offs is that in the United States, the yield on a 10-year Treasury note is around 2.2, 2.25%. The yield on a 10-year German note is about 0.5%. And so what you're hearing in terms of both the interest rate structure, as well as this low inflation across the globe, is that what we've seen and what we were going to continue to see in 2016 is a lot of movement in currencies because there's not going to be a lot of movement at the long end of the yield curve. And it's the long end, not the short end, that really has an impact not only on consumers in terms of mortgage rates, but in terms of business as well. There's another factor that's very important to understand here, and that is that these moves by the Federal Reserve, as well as what the banks do, is all against a background of very little borrowing. Consumers aren't borrowing, business isn't doing that much borrowing, and certainly government, federal, state, and local, is doing very little borrowing. That's why we're seeing, you know, the kinds of moves and the kind of gradualism that the Federal Reserve is talking about.
What about the fact, let me go back to you, Adam Serhan, on this, that we're seeing some strain in a number of financial markets. I mean, investors dumping, for example, high-yield junk bonds and pulling money out from developing nations and developing markets, I should say. I mean, should that give us concern here?
Yeah, I think absolutely. Paying attention to what investors do, and I always say the market is speaking, are you listening, is extremely important to understand what happens in the economy because there tends to be a, you know, 6 to 9 months, not always, but most of the time, difference between what happens on Wall Street, so to speak, and what happens in Main Street, meaning Wall Street leads and then Main Street follows thereafter. Now, what we're seeing is really important for a few different areas that we can cover. First off is that this bull market began in March of 2009. It's going to turn 7 in March of 16, which is an extremely long period of time considering if you look at other past bull markets, they usually end shortly after their fifth anniversary. Look at 2002 to 2007, that was 5 years. In the late 90s, we had a five-year bull. In the 80s, we had a five-year bull. So now we're approaching 7 years. And the reason why this bull market continues to be very strong is because primarily of easy money sloshing around the globe from the Fed and other central banks. So even with yesterday's 0.25 rate hike, it's still maintaining an easy money stance. And that's really important, and it speaks to all the other points that the other panelists are bringing up with respect to, you know, continuing growth and wages and economic activity and housing prices, et cetera, et cetera. Even with rates at, you know, 0.25, if you look back at historical measures of Fed interest rates, 0.25 is extremely, extremely accommodative. Now, that's the first thing. The second part of it, from a cycle standpoint also, is that recessions and then booms and busts, et cetera, we're now, this expansion or this recovery, whatever you want to word it, it's also aging. You know, how long can we go without another recession? And that's the other side of the coin that comes into play as well. So it's got to be factored into the equation of, even if the Fed decides to start raising rates now, what are the ramifications in 6 to 12 months on both Main Street and Wall Street?
Let me go back to you, Mark Schneepin. I want to get a picture from you on maybe even some prognosticating about what you think this means in the short run and the long run for the California economy.
Well, in the short run, I don't know that it really means a lot, like everybody else is saying. You know, it's that symbolic move. So, you know, you may get a little flurry of activity, people trying to take out a loan or something. But I think the bigger issue here is that this is the first of many moves to come. So interest rates are rising, and Adam raises a real good point, and it's going to affect the California economy just as much as the U.S. economy. And that is, you know, we're in the seventh year of a recovery slash expansion. And if you go back to about 1980, we had four recessions. There's and if you take the distance between the trough and the peak of each of them, you get about 9 years. Now, we were at the low in June of 2009, so you had 9 years onto that on average, and you're looking at recession in about 2018. Now, that's statistical. We don't see any recession coming, so it's purely an average given our last four cycles, but we got to be cognizant of that. And so we're raising interest rates here as we go into perhaps statistically a recessionary period here. So what will it mean for the California economy? I don't think you're going to see the full range of interest rate hikes if we start to see slowdowns in the economic data. And that's why Janet Yellen was so careful yesterday to say that when asked by the press, you know, how is she going to see interest rates rising through 2016? Well, we're going to look at the data each and every single time. And that's going to be important because, again, we're in the seventh year of an economic cycle. That's important to know.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing to think that Janet Yellen says something about her leadership, got everyone to go along, including those who argued possibly for the delay of a rate hike. That in itself says a great deal about how the Fed is being essentially managed at this point, new era under her direction. I'm wondering, though, also, Ken Goldstein, if I go back to you, we heard from Adam Starhan about the fact that Wall Street is ready for the rate hike from his perspective, but maybe not Main Street, and also that deflation is more of a threat than inflation. And I'm struck by the fact that they're going to be monitoring inflation. They're going to begin to do this in a gradual tightening schedule, but they're going to try to certainly assure the markets that, well, we're not necessarily into a traditional interest rate cycle.
Look, there's three very important points we have to bring up. One is this is no ordinary expansion period. This is coming off the Great Recession. This is coming off the worst financial crisis in 100 years. That's why we stayed with such very low interest rates for so long. Number two, remember what Janet Yellen said yesterday, and also remember, she's the former president of the San Francisco Fed. She said expansions do not die of old age. You know, recessions do not just happen. Something else has to happen, or some things else has to happen in order to push the U.S. economy into recession. We could be 5 years or more away from the next recession. So this idea that we need to start worrying about that and worrying about it now, that's just simply, you know, worrying about things that we shouldn't spend all that much time on. And inflation, same thing. Inflation is very low, and it's going to remain very low. In fact, that's the bigger problem. is inflation too low, not inflation rising? And last point maybe is that this whole business between Wall Street and Main Street, I would pay more attention to Main Street. That's where most of us live. That's where most of us work. And in terms of Main Street, this is not that big a deal.
Well, I'm wondering, Adam Sarhan, what your response is to that, but also to kind of the larger than elephant in the room here, which one hates to bring up, but is nevertheless apprehensive about, and that's the possibility of global terror attacks.
There's two questions there. So the first question is, I argue that Main Street, Wall Street, and all other streets across the globe are all interdependent. We live in an interdependent world, and what happens in China or Greece or U.S., whatever the case may be, from an economic standpoint, a financial standpoint, or, God forbid, a terrorist standpoint, all matters, and it's part of the equation for the Fed and the rest of both investors and then also decisions that Main Street make. So that's the Main Street, Wall Street point. The other point with respect to another terrorist attack, God forbid, that's unfortunately the world that we live in. There's a lot of different ramifications from terror attacks on both Main Street and Wall Street, but really the important takeaway is it a one-off, an isolated event, or is it a series of, hey, there's a lot more to come? One-off terrorist events, unfortunately, they happen. It's happened throughout history since the beginning of time, and it likely will continue to happen in the future. The good news from an economic standpoint is that it doesn't really have a massive, massive, massive bring the economy to its knees type of a reaction, bearing the size, of course, of the terrorist activity, of course. Now, if it's a series of events and or all-out war breaks out, you know, whether it's geopolitical tensions that escalate or it's just a series of terrorist events and the next thing you know, countries are at war in World War III like they're talking about, et cetera, that completely changes the playing field. And we can't predict any of that type of activity. All we can do is just, do our best to protect from it, and then when it happens, deal with it when it happens. But as far as Main Street's concerned and as far as Wall Street's concerned, you have no choice but to put your best foot forward, protect yourself, and hope things work out well.
Well, I am getting listener responses that are somewhat more pessimistic than we might assume from what the Fed has said. This is a listener, for example, who writes, and I'm going to give all of you an opportunity to join this conversation with any questions or comments you might have, but I just wanted to read this comment on our website, which says, with the current state of the U.S. economy, with a majority of wealth in very few hands and the current wages lagging behind cost of living by a great factor, as well as the tens of trillions of dollars in debt, there's no question we're heading for economic collapse with implosion of the housing bubble and far greater stock market crash than prior ones. No matter what you hear from so-called experts, the U.S. economy is on a downhill course toward one of the worst crashes in history. Anybody want to take that bait?
That just simply is not the case. In fact, you know, economies grow for two reasons. Either you get more people at work, so that's the demographic change, or you get them to work more efficiently. That's the productivity number. And if you roll those two together, U.S. can sustain about a 2% rate of growth. We're currently doing even better than that. That's not going to continue all the way through 2016. But we can get down to and stay at a 2% rate of growth through 2016, 2017, 2018 with very low inflation and with still very low interest rates, although the adjustment across the globe is going to be more on currencies than on interest rates. So this idea that the economy, you know, is slowly grinding to a halt, there's no data that support that.
Okay, Ken Goldstein with us from New York, economist with the Conference Board. And you can be with us as well. In fact, let me invite your calls and emails. You can join us now at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, the number to call, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us, our Twitter handle, @kqedforum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about what the federal interest rate hike may mean for, well, the U.S. economy as well as the California economy. And Federal Reserve rate hike happened yesterday, and we're talking with three experts who are with us by phone. Adam Sarhan is CEO of Sarhan Capital and contributor to Forbes.com. And Ken Goldstein is an economist with the Conference Board in New York City. Mark Schneep is with us from Santa Barbara. He directs the California Economic Forecast, which prepares forecasts and economic commentary on the regional economies of California, and talking really about broad questions such as really the strength of the economy. The decision was made in light of a good deal of bullishness where the economy is concerned, despite strong bear markets that we've been talking about. And Janet Yellen had a lot of questions for the committee. They're counting on economic expansion. Are you confident on that score? And what about inflation often when it's weak, meaning the economy is weak? And looking at, again, some naysaying comments from some of our listeners, and we do invite your involvement in the program, by the way. Let me tell you again how you can join us by phone. The toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Here's an email from Phil, who writes, when the Fed raised the rates yesterday, it took all of 20 seconds for other central banks to follow suit and adjust their rates. Central banks are intended to make adjustments for their own national economies. The globalized economy has made central banks worldwide players in stock markets and financial exchanges. Billionaire investor Sam Zell sees a possible upcoming crash. So there we are again with the kind of, downturn view, I should call it, or pessimistic view. Adam Sarhan, you had said before the economies are all intertwined, and when you hear a comment like that, what do you say?
There's two things. The first thing is, if you look back at the history of this Fed under both Bernanke and Yellen, every time since 09 low or since the financial crisis, because I agree with Ken, we are in a different world today, and that's why these expansions happen and they've extended for so long, every time Wall Street got in trouble, they would enact another round of QE or print more money. So you had QE1 come out at the end of 08/early 09, and that helped stocks bottom. That really lasted all the way up until QE1 ended. Stocks really fell off. And then all of a sudden, Operation Twist and QE2, stocks rallied. And then QE2 ended, stocks fell at the end of 12, and then all of a sudden we announced QE3. That wasn't really good enough. They doubled up again at the end of 12, and the next thing you know, stocks took off in 13 and 14. And then they ended QE last October, and more or less stocks have moved sideways all year this year. The question that I would raise to everybody listening is, what do you think the Fed's going to do if we enter, the next bear market happens in equities on Wall Street? So if you look back at the action that the Fed's been taking, every time Wall Street gets in trouble, they throw more money at it. And it's not just the Fed, it's other central banks as well. So we're in an aging bull market. All bull markets in history have had a definitive beginning and a definitive end. The market has gone nowhere for the last year. It appears to be a large topping process. Every time we get to the top of the trading range, we fall. So I would argue, what would the Fed do if and when the next bull market happens? Either they're going to reverse rates and or enact another round of QE or print more money. So that, from my standpoint, is why we pay attention to Wall Street, because the Fed's watching, and so is the rest of the world.
Well, speaking of the Fed watching, Mark Sneap, before I go to phone calls, let me go to another comment from a listener on our website. Robert writes, the question of where to set interest rates must be harder to answer these days, as inflation seems to vary depending on what part of the economy one is talking about. Many wages and prices remain low due to downward pressure from technology and globalization. On the other hand, things like Bay Area real estate and the salaries of top corporate executives reside in a world of rampant inflation. Boiling all these things down into one inflation rate for setting policy is problematic. Mark?
You know, we are seeing the highest inflation rates in the nation occur in the Bay Area, not so much in Southern California, but in the Bay Area. So your that question is correct. And the previous question that you read, the writer suggested, well, he didn't suggest, he actually said, or at least alleged, that housing is in another bubble. Well, we don't believe that at all. Certainly, the Bay Area economy is probably the most vibrant economy in the world today. It's got some of the lowest unemployment rates we have ever seen, and certainly the housing prices are in double-digit inflation. They're rising very sharply, but is that really bubble-like? It's really due more from supply and demand forces and not from some kind of speculatory motivations. So right now, what you're seeing in the Bay Area is a very, very hot market, and it does tend to be driving up prices, not only of housing, but of wages and salaries because of the tech boom that's going on there. So, yeah, we are seeing differential rates of inflation, but still it's only running at about 3.5% in the Bay Area. Still very, very contained.
And again, Mark Sneap is director of the California Economic Forecast in Santa Barbara. And let me go to your calls, and let's begin with you, Ken. You're on. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. I think we're leaving out a couple of things here. The business between wages and prices are getting more and more skewed. the fact that we have what is traditionally known as full employment, which was in the old days 5%, and has come down several years ago during Clinton, was down to 2%. So that's not a real number because so many people are triply employed, which means that the economy isn't working, for one thing. Second thing, this whole thing about housing and the housing bubble here, it is being fueled by investors. There's investors coming from the East. There's investors coming from Asia big time because we're, you know, my friends are in the commercial business. We know where the money's coming from. So your guess is not exactly accurate. And then the third thing that they're not dealing with is federal spending policy. The biggest part of most impact on the on wages and prices is federal spending. Federal spending is very skewed towards the military, which is high spending, low number of workers, and thereby the whole economy is very tilted. If the government spending were more tilted instead of towards the military, towards domestic needs, you would have higher employment and higher wages, and still have the same effect on the economy as a whole, except it would be much stronger, thereby balancing things out a lot more, thereby increasing the need for commodities, thereby bringing actually the rest of the world more in tune. So we have a very skewed economy that is not being addressed by any of your guests.
Ken, I thank you for those points, all three of them. And actually, they're all salient points. I'd like to go to, actually first to you, Mark Schneep, on the point about not really seeing what's going on with the housing bubble.
Well, it is the case that the investors have come in and bought up homes, bought up apartments and things like that. Most of that was done earlier.
It's a lot of foreign buying of homes, Mark, especially here in the Bay Area. A lot of people from China and England particularly, in fact.
And people are living in those homes, and the demand is still very, very high for those homes.
Or they're giving them out to Airbnb, I'm not sure. Yeah.
That's a whole other issue. That's true, and we're seeing that all over coastal California. So, Michael, that's a whole other show you should have on this.
Well,
topic.
We've done it. We'll probably do it again. Yeah, the caller has a point, though. I think
demand issue in the Bay Area as well as all the coastal California. We really don't have much supply, and yet you have significant amount of demand. You've got a rush for employment. You've got significant job creation. You've got just such a vibrant economy right there. You don't see the speculatory kinds of effects that we saw in the last bubble. So this is really being driven by forces that are sort of natural in economics and not bubble-like.
Well, on the other hand, let's get to the other points that caller made. He was talking about unemployment, Ken Goldstein. He made it seem like, again, that the figures are not necessarily accurate and maybe even jiggered to a great degree.
Well, one of the things we have to pay attention to, in addition to this recovery from the Great Recession, is also that the demographics have changed dramatically in the United States. Our population growth rate has slowed down very sharply, and our labor force participation has fallen off. Some of that is actually voluntary. So that this whole idea about, you know, is 5% the ideal, is 4.5%, which is where we're going, is that the number that will trigger faster increases in wages? The other point he made, which is very good and really is a very strong point to bring into all of this, we're spending all this time looking at monetary policy, which is always weaker than fiscal policy, but we're doing it precisely because fiscal policy is in gridlock, and not just at the federal level, even at the state and local level. And the other thing to remember about that is for every dollar we spend out of Washington, we're spending $2 at the state and local level. And so even though we're talking about this recovery from the expansion in terms of property tax, sales tax, income tax, it has not been enough in most states, certainly not in California, even to bring back some of the cuts that were made in order to get to where we are now. And so one of the other issues here is we're asking so much of monetary policy precisely because we can't get our act together on fiscal policy, not at the federal level, not the state level, not even at City Hall.
Let me bring some more callers on. Let me go to you next, Ruth Ann. Thank you for waiting. Join us.
Yeah, I wanted to know what either of the guests thought about what the impact of the rate change will be on pension funds that have been reluctant to invest because of the traditionally safe investments like bonds and things like that because the interest rates are so low?
Thank you for that question, Ruthann. Adam Sarhan?
That's a great question. In general, the Fed and other central banks have almost forced investors' hands into riskier assets over the last, really, 6.5 years by keeping rates artificially low. At this juncture, rates are still extremely low, and the Fed is directly hurting savers by keeping rates so low, especially that they're keeping them rates artificially low. So a quarter point move doesn't really move the needle, but if we start seeing more of a normalization of rates and or above 1%, 2%, somewhere in that range in the next 18 to 24 months, that could change the playing field.
Let me thank Ruthann for her call. And again, you can join us toll-free, 866-733-6786. Here's Christopher. Christopher, you're on the air.
Hi. As I said, my name is Christopher, and since we've got the economists in the room here, I wanted to move to a question about the housing markets, especially in light that the last recession that we had was all based on the housing bubble. Could I get some comments on the fact that many surveys have stated that millennials are waiting to buy houses, and this is impacting the housing markets, and what sort of impacts that would be? That's my main question, and thanks for taking my question.
All right, I thank you for the question. The millennials, you want to see how they figure in this or give us some illumination on that, Adam Sarhan?
I don't think they have money. I don't think it has anything to do with their, you know, predisposed beliefs or different points of view. If you look at it, it comes down to dollars and cents. Millennials can't afford houses, period. End of story.
Unless they're working high up in the tech sector doing coding and things like that, yeah.
And then, if you look in the Bay Area, what is the percentage out of all of millennials that have those high-end paying jobs? It's nominal at best. And if you extrapolate that all over the country, that's therein lies the problem with this economy and the jobs creation, et cetera, et cetera. People across the globe, at all different generations, they simply don't have money, and the cost of living has soared. Prices are out of whack. You know, for a starting family, for a young family to get married and have one kid and buy a house, what type of income do you have after taxes to be able to afford to live in a nice neighborhood? You tell me. I mean, it's just it's out of whack.
Especially in this neighborhood here in the Bay Area. Let me thank the caller and go to an email here. Let me go to you on this, Ken Goldstein. One of our listeners wants to know, how will the rate rise affect insurance premiums? Is it worth waiting if you're shopping for life insurance?
Well, this is very interesting, and maybe the other two financial guests would be better at this. But in any event, A, it's a small move. B, it's at the short end of the yield curve. And C, it's likely to have a minimal impact in terms of borrowing rates, likely to have even less impact on savings rates. And even that is going to take more time. So, you know, what's going to happen here for savers, whatever instrument you put your money in, this, you know, this whole move is a minimal move, even less so for savers than for borrowers.
Another question on our Facebook page, and Mark Schneep, let me go to you on this. So we're talking about housing costs a good deal. This is Jack who writes, my fiancé and I are looking to buy a house, so we don't want rates to raise, but we can't get the loan we want because I'm self-employed, and with the rates so low, they're more strict on who they give loans to. With the rates raising, it's speculated that loans will be less restricted. Can you comment, Mark?
Yeah, well, it depends on their sort of risk tolerance here and how they project how the economy is going to go going forward. I mean, this would be the time, as I said earlier, to pull the trigger and try to find something affordable, at least relatively affordable, that they could get into right now because, again, rates are going to be rising here. However, as rates rise and hopefully as the economy does start to cool off a little, particularly in the Bay Area, and we do anticipate that to happen, then you'll see price appreciation start to, you know, mellow out some. There is also that idea, which we raised earlier, which deals with when is the next recession? You know, perhaps it may be best to wait until the next slowdown in the economy. But as Ken said, it could be 5 years from now because we're coming off really one of the worst downturns since the 1930s, 1940s. So that may not be the best decision to make either. So, but right now, I would say that supply is very, very low. Prices still are going. This is not a buyer's market. This is a seller's market right now. I would hold off on the buying decision at this moment.
Let me go to another caller, and thank you for waiting, Robert. You're on the air. Morning.
Good morning. I had a question about how this is going to affect state and localities' government spending, especially localities that have been doing heavy borrowing and or basically been running a deficit.
Ken Goldstein.
Well, you know, that's part of the problem is it's not that the cost is going to go up for different projects just because the Fed raised at the short end by 25 points. The bigger problem is where's the revenue? Even if you want to float a bond issue, where's the revenue to support that? And I think that's why even though we've got terrible problems with our bridges and roads and tunnels, we also need to fix the grid. We can't get the officials that we elect to agree on anything. And B, even if we do, where's the revenue for those projects?
I'm looking at some more emails here, and let me go to one from Alexandra and go to you, Adam Sarhan. I've been talking a lot about Main Street and Wall Street, and Alexandra writes, it's hard for me to take these experts seriously when my personal experience of inflation is that the things I actually spend money on, food and housing, is continually rising and far exceeding any adjustments to my salary. The world they're talking about has nothing to do with actual Main Street.
Yeah, that's exactly the point. There's a massive, massive disconnect. People don't have money. They can't afford basic necessities and goods and services. I don't want to make an extreme and paint a doom and gloom picture, but if you look at a normal house in a good neighborhood, anywhere in the country, even the Bay Area, but let's just take New York and the Bay Area out of the equation, you're going to spend $500,000-$600,000 for a house. As a down payment, you need 20% if you can get the loan to begin with. That's $100,000-$150,000 for closing costs and just buy furniture, et cetera. Okay, so you're a young couple, you get out of school. Let's just assume you're not buried with hundreds of thousands of dollars in student debt. But let's just say you have a little bit of student debt. Let's say you have no student debt. How are you going to possibly save $150,000 cash in your 20s?
Just a second.
When you're getting a normal job, working, climbing the corporate ladder. So that's therein lies the problem. And that's why there's a big drag on the economy from all these people, not just at young in the 20s, even people in their 30s or 40s or 50s, even their 60s that weren't fiscally responsible and or haven't saved and or don't know how to manage money. It all comes down to cash flow, how much goes out and how much comes in every month or week or day, whatever time frame you want to use. And it's really, really tough for lots and lots and lots of people, millions, tens of millions of people, just to go about their normal day, to buy normal stuff.
Did I hear your voice, Ken?
Yeah, I want to jump in here and just simply make one simple point, because we're hearing doom and gloom and dire and so forth. When we survey here at the Conference Board the average American consumer, and we do this every single month, these surveys, and it's not just ours, but certainly looking at ours, isn't picking up that the general mood out there. There are some people, yes, who are very worried, and some of them, you know, with good cause. But that's not the average American consumer at the end of 2015, not according to these, you know, these polls of consumer sentiment.
That's heartening to hear. Let me bring another caller on here, and we'll go to you. Claudia, you're on the air.
Yes, who are very worried.
Claudia, are you there? I'm hearing the radio.
I'm here. I'm right here.
All right. I think we told her to turn off the radio and do it. I want to go to a tweet here because Miguel tweets, perhaps another thing to consider, could our GDP see slower growth after our pledge to cut down on CO2 emissions? Ken Goldstein?
No, actually, what we're looking at here is that, you know, what we're going to do, not only now, but over the next decade in terms of trying to green the economy, this is good for economic growth. So, you know, what we're doing in terms of trying to make the transition away from fossil fuel to more renewable fuel and a greener economy, this is good for jobs. This is good for wages now and over the next decade.
Another listener writes, and this is Aaron writing, Adam Sarhan, my biggest concern is about commodities crash. What do you think about weakness in commodities and the effects on banks and lenders who finance them? Although the U.S. economy might be able to weather this situation with ease, is the effect on some many economies that are dependent on commodities of concern?
Yeah, I mean, just look at the facts. Right now, Canada, they're in a recession and or GDP is slowing considerably. Australia, same situation. Japan, which is not even a commodity producer, but their net import, they buy, their economy is slowing down. So we're seeing weakness across the globe. And what's happening is no matter what you do with the banks who finance it or any of the commodity producers that are involved, it's not just one area of the commodity market. You look at every commodity sector. You've got agriculture commodities in bear markets, soybeans, wheat, corn, etc. You've got soft commodities like sugar and coffee in bear markets. You've got the metals in bear markets, copper, aluminum, zinc, gold, silver, bear markets. You've got the energy, crude oil, RBOB gasoline futures, nat gas futures. Nat gas futures are at the lowest level since 2002, I believe it is. And you've got crude oil now at the lowest level since 2008. So you're in a situation where, you know, worldwide deflation, and again, this is not gloom and doom. This is not necessarily a bad thing. The economy can continue to grow in that type of an environment. People can continue, the stocks can continue to go up. The important thing to understand here is bear markets happen, and we're seeing them across the globe in many different asset classes. The key message here is to continue to watch the U.S. stock market, because that's the last bull market really standing, and of course the U.S. dollar. But this bull market is aging. When it does end, be very, very careful not to be caught on the wrong side of it, because if the market does fall 50% like it did in 08 or even more like it did in 2000 when the dot-com bubble burst, lots of the Bay Area listeners know, the NASDAQ fell 78%, almost 80% in a year and a half, almost 2 years. So just be very, very, very careful and watch the downside if the selling begins to roll over and hit U.S. stocks.
And again, Adam Sarhan is CEO of Sarhan Capital and contributor to Forbes.com. I just want to read one more upbeat where the economy is concerned. Listener comment. This listener writes, the American economy is thriving and we're all feeling it. It's wonderful news. Thank you, President Obama. It's so great that home values, salaries, investments and bonuses are all doing well and much better. Of course, there will eventually be other downturns, but we're doing quite well now. Some folks enjoy complaining, but the data are clear on the current state of our economy and society. And here, you on this, Mark. Mark Sneap again directs the California Economic Forecast in Santa Barbara. This is Steve up in Santa Rosa here who says, I love the voluntary unemployment comment. When you give up looking for work and stop looking, is that really voluntary? Are the Uber drivers really employed?
Well, they are employed. They're contract employees, but they're still employed. We're almost at that point. In fact, we're at that point, depending upon the job that you get, that if you can fog a mirror, you can get a job right now. It may not be the exact job that you want, but, you know, as we reach full employment going into next year, not only in the U.S. but in California, it will be the case that you'll be able to get almost any job that you want, certainly more of your ideal job, because we're going to be having a labor shortage. Can you ever imagine that? Just 5 years ago, look where we were in terms of unemployment and the employment situation in the country, and now we may be actually facing a labor shortage in 2016 going into 2017. So these unemployment figures that we're seeing are real. And just to comment on something that Adam was talking about in terms of bear markets, you know, we're at a particular point in time in the economy, which is very, very unique. We've got essentially zero inflation. We've got some of the lowest gasoline prices we've seen in a decade. And we've got some of the lowest interest rates we've seen in, well, almost our entire lifetimes. So all of these things are conspiring to really help the consumer out right now. We haven't really been in this kind of a situation in years, if ever, for that matter. So while all these writers and callers are talking about the doom and gloom of the U.S. economy, you know, in many other ways you could look at it, we're sort of in another golden age of the U.S. economy in terms of all of these particular indicators conspiring to give us a very interesting consumer world right now.
Looking at a number of questions from listeners, and let me get to as many as I can here. Justin, for example, and let me go to our economist Ken Goldstein on this, says, can you discuss the method the Fed will use to raise the rates? I understand that for the first time, the Fed will be paying interest on money the banks set aside in order to motivate them to raise rates. They would charge more than the Fed pays or not loan the money. And how will this be funded? How long can this method last, and does it create any unintended consequences?
It doesn't create unemployment consequences, but it does reflect, as I said before, that one of the problems in this economy is you've got consumers, business, and government at all levels that isn't doing that much borrowing. That is forcing the Fed to take some of these steps in order to try to normalize interest rates, a step that's very necessary not to, you know, necessarily change where the economy is. But monetary policy is all about where the economy is going in 12 or 24 months. And so I think that's why, you know, we're seeing the Fed move the way that they did, and while they'll move one or two times perhaps in 2016. This is all about where the economy is going to be and where inflation and where employment is going to be in 2017 and 2018. And again, I want to come back to this idea that, you know, it's not necessarily a Goldilocks economy. 2% growth is nothing really to write home about. But if 2% is about the average of what we can do on a sustained basis, and that's where we are or even a little bit above that, if it's not Goldilocks, it ain't that bad.
Let me go to a final question for you, Adam Serhan, as we're coming up toward the end of the hour here. Steve wants to know, there's quite a bit of discussion of the low growth that is 2% range for the GDP over the next 3 years or so. Seems to me that the big issue here is really the divergence of wealth and the rise of income inequality and the demise of a strong middle class, which has been the key driver for growth since the end of World War II. With the current budget bill before Congress, we seem to miss the point that the middle class and hence economic growth is under assault by our politicians, and I'd suggest that this is why the recovery has been so slow.
It speaks to the point that we've been making the whole show. It's that there's a big discrepancy between how much money is in the bank, how much money is coming in, and how much has to go out. If you're an Uber driver, as Mark made the point earlier, even though the unemployment rate's at 5%, that's sure, fine. There's a lot of low-quality jobs out there. People have to work. But how can you grow and thrive in that kind of environment when you're just not making enough money? That's where the problem is.
Of course,
you're saddled with debt, et cetera, et cetera.
We'll have to leave it there with the problem, but continue to look for solutions. And thanks to Adam Serhan, again, CEO of Serhan Capital and contributor to Forbes.com, who joined us this morning from New York. Thanks, Ken Goldstein, economist at the Conference Board, also joined us from New York. And thank you to Mark Schneep, director of the California Economic Forecast, which prepares forecasts and economic commentary on the regional economies of California. And Mark joined us from Santa Barbara. I'm glad that you all joined us. I thank you for your participation in this morning's program and for your listenership. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, but today it's Howard Gelman. Our engagement editor is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Natalie Yemenijan. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our interns, LaToya Tools and Jeremy Siegel. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.